Friday guest today is one half of daytime TV superstar presenting duo Richard and Judy. Judy is very well known, of course, but she couldn't wait to get out of television. Couldn't wait to get out of it. Found it boring at the end. So there's some interesting stuff in this interview. And of course, Judy has interviewed thousands of celebs over the year. And I began by asking her if she's ever been starstruck by anyone she's interviewed.
There were some people when we who we interviewed that I was definitely starstruck by, and I don't like that feeling. Yeah. Because, you know, you kind of, it makes you feel a bit shy, and really there's not much point in interviewing somebody if you're just going to be shy. I'm thinking about people like Tom Hanks, for example, or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton, or, you know, and these people do seem sort of massively important, and you feel so small and insignificant sitting next to them asking them silly questions.
Well, in terms of Tom Hanks and Bill Clinton, were you starstruck or did you fancy them?
No, I didn't fancy them. Actually, Bill Clinton, when we interviewed him, he wasn't at his most charismatic. And very shortly after that, I'm sure it was nothing to do with our interview, he had a heart attack and he had to go into hospital. I remember feeling that when we interviewed him, because he'd come over to Britain, he looked very, very tired. And he was fantastic to talk to. He was, extremely interesting. But there was not that kind of incredibly sort of sexy twinkle that one reads about all the time.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you talk about his lack of charisma on that occasion. I was lucky enough, I flew over to New York a few years ago to interview him, and I have never met anyone with as much presence walking into a room.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I honestly understand that and I accept it. And I think the thing was, he was very, very... He gave us a perfectly good interview. He was terrific, and he's very, very interesting and very unpompous, you know. I mean, for such a sort of hugely important man, he's not patronising at all. But he was definitely looking tired. And as I say, very shortly after that, he became ill. And I think he must have been sort of incubating that illness when he flew over to London.
You see, here we are talking already, right at the very top of this interview, about what you've done on TV and the interviews. And yet I read that you'd said that you never felt comfortable on television.
Well, that's not entirely true. I did feel comfortable on television. I did feel comfortable interviewing and all the rest of it. I think certainly towards the end, I'd got fed up of it. I just actually had literally sort of had enough. We've been doing it for so long, you know, and daily live television, which is what we did, is tremendously time consuming. It kind of dominates your whole life. And I began certainly in the last couple of years or so, I began to sort of want to have more control over my own time. I wanted to go in other directions. I wanted to write, I wanted to spend more time with my family. And I just want, and I just had enough. I just needed a change.
You see, that's probably difficult for people outside of the business to understand, because they perceive television to be so exciting.
Yes. Yes, and indeed it is. And, you know, you hear yourself, I hear myself talking to you about interviewing Bill Clinton and Tom Hanks, and it sounds amazingly exciting. And in some ways it is. And individual interviews often are. I mean, they are fantastic. But the fact of the matter is that when you're doing a daily live TV show, you have a show to fill every day, and those beautiful, wonderful, charismatic creatures who make perfect interviewees are few and far between, but you still have to fill your show. So you do find yourself talking to a lot of people who are not, to put it mildly, who are not Bill Clinton. And after a while, you kind of feel that you've asked all the questions and stuff like that.
You know, were you getting bored?
Well, a little sometimes, yes, with some of the interviews that we did. I mean, I often say, I mean, I love actors, but I felt if I had to interview another soap star about his or her plot line, I'd go bonkers, you know, because much as I love talking to them, it just all feels a bit of an artificial construct when you're, you know, I'd rather talk about real things. I'd rather talk about, rather than celebrity interviews, I'd rather talk about, I don't know, journalistic ones or something like that.
You see, this is what I read. I found it now, where you said, I never felt secure on television. Don't miss it at all. I don't like being in the limelight. At times it felt as if I was on a treadmill. And this was the line for me where I wondered, my goodness, TV sucked the life out of me. You
know? Did I really say that?
Yeah.
Gosh, what you say in interviews. I know what I meant, though, by that. It did feel as if it had come to dominate my life, and I didn't want my life being dominated by that. I wanted a bit more time for me and my family.
Well, you talk about real life issues, and I present 8 radio shows a week and have phone-ins, and it's funny when you talk about that it started to dominate your life, because that's akin to a subject we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, people feeling that their job was stressing them out, mm-hmm. and was making them unhappy. Like, did you get to the stage where it started to make you unhappy?
I wouldn't say I was unhappy. I just wanted a change. I mean, I've been incredibly lucky in that I worked with Richard for all those years, and that was great because, we kind of looked out for each other, and, we knew each other very well, and we found that we interviewed together very well and we presented together very well. So I was lucky that way. I never got bored with that, but I just wanted, people... I think when you're doing the kind of telly that we do, people expect you, as you said, to remain tremendously excited and thrilled by it. But in the end, it is a job, and some of the job's great, and like all jobs, some of it's pretty boring and tiring. That's all.
Was it all downhill after you left this morning?
Downhill? No. Channel 4 was great for us.
In terms of enjoyment, though, because that was the heyday of at least it was relatively new compared to what you did afterwards. I know you were at it for a long time, but after that you were doing a similar show again on another channel. That's what I mean.
It was a different kind of... it was a completely different slot, of course. We were doing a tea time, which is, again, it was kind of carving out a slot like we had in on This Morning, which had... simply not feature really much on TV before. So it was a challenge, like This Morning. And I was very pleased, actually, with the Channel 4 show, because we did manage to get more journalism into it than rather than lifestyle. And the lifestyle on This Morning was tremendously important, the beauty and the cooking and the fashion and all that, which is great. But I think my first love, and also Richard's, was always interviewing people, human interest stories and popular journalism, really. And we did a lot of that at Channel 4. I really liked it. No, I just... simply, got to the point where I wanted to try something else, and I very much wanted to write, and I just didn't have the time to write when I was doing TV every day.
You presented This Morning from its inception, 1988 until 2001. Mm-hmm. How scary is it approaching a major broadcaster like ITV and saying, "We're gone. That's it.
It was
cheerio."
It was quite traumatic, actually. But I don't know, TV can get very political, and there were all sorts of political ins and outs going on at that particular time.
It got nasty, though?
No, it didn't get nasty. It was all very, very civilised. But it was, it was a bit traumatic to say we're going, and they didn't want us to go, and they tried very hard to keep us. But we had decided yet again that it was time for a change, and we went somewhere else.
Was that Richard New against the world? Like, why? Why not stay at the major broadcaster? Why take the risk of moving on?
We never saw it as a risk. I mean, we wanted to change. We wanted to do something different, which is precisely what has driven me now to stop doing the television. I don't know, but if you're doing TV every day and you're doing the same programme every day live, it becomes a bit like Groundhog Day sometimes. Everything is the same. Sometimes you kind of feel as if you might as well have just slept overnight in the studio rather than gone home, because it's all exactly the same the next day. People need changes. Maybe not everyone needs changes, but I do.
You see, I'm quite keen to get to know you a little bit during this interview, and it just strikes me from what you've said about you making that decision and you didn't see it as a risk. That's someone who is... well, it sounds like someone who is headstrong, who is determined, who has a lot of self-confidence.
I'm certainly headstrong. I remember writing, Rich and I wrote a joint autobiography several years back, and when I was looking back at it and rereading it, and I thought, God, I never realised how stubborn I was. I think I am stubborn, there's no doubt about it, but I wouldn't say I've got a lot of self-confidence. I believe that in doing something to the best of your ability and feeling that you're doing a good job. But no, I mean, I'm stubborn, yes, definitely stubborn.
But Julian, what area of life do you lack self-confidence?
I'm just not a very confident person. I mean, I think that, the kind of background I had, which was very working class and very...
Born in Manchester, right?
In Manchester, born in Manchester, yeah. And very working class and very a mother particularly who was extremely aspirational for all her children, and you know, was determined that we would do really well at school and that we'd go to university, which we all did, all three of us did, and that was quite I mean, we were the first generation in that whole extended family to go to university, all of us, and win scholarships and stuff like that, and that was very much down to my mother, and she never really praised, and I think maybe that's partly it, you know, she just expected that you'd do well and was very disappointed if you didn't. So I don't think that really, you know, I was brought up not to show off.
How does it make you feel as a child when your mum isn't saying well done?
I'm ambivalent about it now, because the thing is, although I don't think it's a particularly good way to bring up a child myself, and I've sort of, with my lot, I've tried very hard to show them that my love for them is completely unconditional. It doesn't matter how well they do or how badly they do. I mean, that I love them whatever. My mother was cut from a different cloth, and which can make things difficult. But on the other hand, her methods worked, in the sense that, as I say, both I and my two brothers did very, very well at school and all went to university and all got bloody good jobs afterwards. So what she did was, what she did worked, but I don't think it's the happiest way to bring up a child. I don't think it's the most joyful way to bring up a child.
So your mum didn't love you unconditionally?
Well, I'm sure she did. She did love me unconditionally. Of course she did. She was my mum, and I loved her. But she was a demanding mother. She was demanding. She expected us to do well. She expected us to work hard. She expected us to do our homework, etc., etc.
See, that's really interesting, real life territory. The pressure, how much pressure a parent puts on their child, as opposed to allowing a child to enjoy childhood, because you only get it once.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. And also, you know, I love having a happy atmosphere at home. I love having, we're a very close family. I've got four children and we're all very close and we see a lot of each other. And, you know, we all get on incredibly well. And to me, that's worth diamonds. You know, that's worth everything.
So do you think you smother your children in the kind of unconditional, no pressure love that maybe you didn't experience as a child?
No, I don't smother them at all. I would just say that I'm demonstrative, and I obviously they're well aware that I love them, and I don't, but I don't smother them. I let them be, to be honest with you, and it's worked very well. I mean, we can talk about anything. They talk to us about anything. You know, there are no go areas in the house.
Your mum did love reading, didn't she?
She did love reading. She particularly loved Shakespearean plays, funnily enough. And she used to go around. She used to go around. One of her most common quotes was, "Well met, fair Titania," or something from A Midsummer Night's Dream. She loved all that. And I certainly have always loved reading. I would say the main brains in my family came from my dad, but she encouraged me to read. And I've always loved it. I did English at university and I've always wanted to write. And finally, when we came to the end of the daily TV stuff, I actually finally managed the time and I wrote Eloise.
And the debut novel is out in paperback this week. It's already
indeed
a bestseller.
Yes, I'm thrilled, surprised, delighted and extremely relieved when you're writing your first book, particularly when Richard and I have been so involved with books, with the book club and everything for so much of our professional lives, that you kind of think, oh my God, you know, if people think it's rubbish, it's going to be a double blow, really. But I've been hugely relieved and delighted at people's responses and the very nice things they've said, and I love doing it.
And you can probably hear from my accent, I'm Irish. I live in Belfast 4 days a week, 3 days in Manchester. And the inspiration for your book came from something very close to certainly us in Northern Ireland, the death of Karen Keeling.
Yes. Yes, Karen was a good friend of ours. Our two families spent a lot of time together. And Cornwall, which is where Eloise, my book, is set, was very precious to both sets of families. Karen and her husband Russ had a house in Cornwall, so did I and Richard, and we spent a lot of time together there on beaches and stuff with the kids. We saw an awful lot of each other, and So it's the combination, really, of Cornwall and the sheer tragedy of Karen passing away as she did when she was only 41. You know, yeah. I mean, it's just unbelievably horrible, and leaving her two young children and her husband behind. And we were all obviously grief stricken and very miserable. And I couldn't get, especially the motherhood idea, I couldn't get that out of my mind, what it must be like to know that you're leaving a young family. And that's how the idea of my book came to me. It's not Karen, Eloise isn't Karen, it's pure fiction, but nevertheless the kind of the germ of the idea of what would it be like if a young woman who died prematurely from breast cancer went and leaving a very young family, what would happen if she was so desperately worried about the safety of her own family, the children she'd left behind. She felt she had to try and sort of communicate from beyond the grave. That's why it's a ghost story, and it's also a psychological thriller. She starts to haunt, if you like, in her dreams at least, her best friend Kathy. And Kathy, she begins to tell Kathy and let her know that things are very strange, and her death was not that it seemed, and she believes her children are in danger and only Kathy can save them. But Kathy, who is the main character in the book, the main protagonist, she has a history of if you like, mental fragility, and she's had depression and stuff like that, and so nobody believes her.
And are you drawing on your own personal experience there? Right.
Yes, certainly in terms of depression. I had very bad postnatal depression after my last child was born. It's 25 years ago, but I think once you've been through something like that, it does stay with you. And when I was writing about Kathy's depression, I drew very much on that.
I'm making a documentary as we speak. We're just in the edit stage on depression and on the stigma that is still associated in 2013 with depression.
Yes, I think postnatal depression specifically is a little more accepted now. I mean, people look out for it more. When you get postnatal depression and you've had a perfectly wonderful, healthy baby, you're very happy, you've got a lovely family, you've got a good marriage, and you are so sad and unhappy, really. You don't understand what's happening to you, and you don't label it. You certainly didn't when I had it. You don't label it, think, oh, I must have postnatal depression. You just think you're going slightly bonkers. And it took me a long time to realise what was happening. I actually, in the end, got help from my GP, who diagnosed clinical postnatal depression straight away and put me on antidepressants. And within 2 or 3 weeks, I just felt a different person. It was just amazing. And there shouldn't be a stigma. You know, these things, our brains are part of our body. You know, just as if something goes horribly wrong with whether you get a really bad infection or something goes wrong with your heart or you break your ankle or whatever, you know, your brain is part of you. It's physical. And when you get depressed, it's not a comment on you. It's a comment on how well the chemistry of your brain is working and whether it's functioning properly. And under certain circumstances, in postnatal depression, it's hormonal probably. Your brain chemistry alters, and you need a drug, you need a pill, just like an antibiotic for an infection. You need a pill to straighten you out, and they're not addictive or anything like that.
See Judy, there's an example of how I'm not as good a presenter as you. I haven't got to the end of the interview and I'm running out of time. Your timing must be far better than mine. Listen, the book sounds fantastic because it sounds, although it is fiction, as if there's a lot of reality in there. Congratulations on the success of it.
Thank you.
And I wish you all the very best, Judy.
Thank you very much indeed.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you.